This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Today we're in L'Alpe d'Huez.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're in the Palais des Sports at the top of Alpe d'Huez. The tour is, well, apart from the final day of the Champs-Élysées, the tour is basically over. Oh.
Hello, Lionel. My name's Richard Moore, Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, Daniel Freib.
Hello.
We're on a bit of a squeaky table here. We'll have to avoid making that squeak. Well, what a thrilling stage that was. I mean, we've been sort of finding it all a bit flat the last few days, haven't we, I think?
No. I think you'll find that since Piazza
Daniel's pendulum has been swinging back towards Nairo Quintana.
Yeah, in one direction. One direction. That's the first time we've mentioned them on this Tour de France. However, I'm feeling quite smug because this is kind of how I predicted that it would go. It was just a question of how far that pendulum was going to swing, and it almost got to horizontal, but didn't quite get there, did it? It stopped 1.5 minutes short.
You asked Chris. We should explain what happened. Lionel, that's your job.
Well, what happened? Alexandre Genies of the Francis Desjeux team attacked basically in a neutralised zone.
He's been really inspired by listening to our Kilometre Zero podcasts. And as a tribute to those, because they've now finished, as a tribute to those, he attacked at Kilometre Zero.
He did, and he got a good lead. He rode very well. And then there was a little counter move behind, which had some of the usual suspects you would expect in there, Ryder Heisdal, Thibaut Pinot and co. And on the Alp itself, there was a bit of a chase down, really, wasn't there?
I mean, you say that winner Anacona was in there as well, the Colombian rider from Movistar, which would prove crucial.
That was extremely significant, yeah. So Thibaut Pinot won the stage, a really excellent stage win in the mould of sort of Bardet's stage win, really. The young French riders have had a very fine final week. And behind them, the battle for the yellow jersey, Nairo Quintana really laid it down to Chris Froome in the way that we hoped he would do, perhaps just maybe once more often than he did. If he'd done that a couple, you know, maybe yesterday, you know, the tour might have been even closer. But it was an excellent move by Quintana, bridging up to winner Anacona, his teammate. And Anacona did an incredible job of work, setting a great pace, putting Chris Froome and Team Sky on the back foot a bit. And as we heard in the press conference afterwards, Chris Froome's not been at his absolute best the last few days, suffering with a bit of chesty cough. He did look like he was rocking at times, but the time gap never went up quite enough to swing the pendulum his way, as Daniel was hoping maybe it would happen.
Let's not open that can of worms. I've already been accused on Twitter multiple times over the last few days of being a closet Movistar fan.
Nine claws about it. You're wearing a Movistar jersey.
Well, for the benefit of the listeners, Daniel's not wearing a Movistar jersey. I think what we wanted to see a really good race. And today we saw a really good race. We saw a great race for the stage. You know, Ryder Heisdal versus Thibaut Pinot at one point. And we saw a really great race for the yellow jersey. And I'm trying to remember a day when watching the race unfold like that in the final stages, it certainly, as Daniel said, the last hour really was gripping stuff. And it's just a shame that the tour was probably just too hard at certain moments. We didn't see enough of that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we had quite a few comments really following last night's podcast where we were quite critical of Chris Froome for complaining in the terms that he did about Vincenzo and Nibali attacking when Froome had a problem. Now, you know, there are problems and there are problems. Froome had a stone stuck in his brake. He stopped and got rid of it. Now, Nibali wasn't to know that. His bike might have been broken for all he knew. The question really was whether Nibali had broken this code of honour, this unwritten rule. And I think what we were expressing last night was a sort of dissatisfaction with the vagueness of that, because it's not at all clear. And it could be abused. And I don't think we meant that Chris Froome would be likely to abuse that, but any rider could abuse that if that was the sort of the normal etiquette. But there was an incident today at the bottom of Alpe d'Huez where Vincenzo Nibali punctured and had a bike change. Now, nobody waited for him. And it does seem strange, bizarre, that this rule only applies for the rider in the yellow jersey.
Chris Froome did address this in the press conference after the stage. He was asked about why he'd expressed himself in such strong terms, and he said that he felt it would be a shame if these little traditions were to fall by the wayside, and he said that it's a sort of symbol of respect between the riders. But I'm not sure, you know, what tradition. I can't really recall, you know, many occasions where everybody has sort of stopped and gone, oh, after you, just because the yellow jersey's had a problem. At the end of the day, we are here to watch a bike race between men on bikes, and we want to see them. We want to see them race. And part of it, as Daniel said very succinctly yesterday, part of the job of the Tour de France is to get yourself and your bike around France as quickly as you possibly can. And if you've got a problem with your bike and a stone catches in the brakes, that's kind of one of those freak things that can happen, just as a puncture or a chain falling off or a crash.
And of course, it can happen in week one, week two, and, you know, different. The rule is applied differently according to the time.
Well, particularly when you look now and we can see the whole Tour de France in context, and Nairo Quintana lost 1 minute 28 to Chris Froome in the crosswind stage through virtually no fault of his own. He was caught behind a split in the bunch.
Well, I think the trick in riding crosswinds is you ride at the front or near to the front so that you're less likely to be caught in a split behind.
Okay.
I don't buy that.
So maybe not no fault of his own, but through some misfortune.
Through not being able to ride that well in crosswinds.
Yes, true. That absolutely. So, you know, but if you, then, so this is where we're getting into the thing that we were getting into last night and again today in the car. That where do you draw the line and where do you say, well,
you two are getting very fastidious. I think we should need to zoom out and think about the big picture here.
You know, and actually, we're talking about something we talked about last night. There was a thrilling bike race today, Lionel.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Lionel. There was a thrilling bike race today. It was fascinating. It was fascinating at the front and further down the mountain. And Froome was clearly struggling. He had two teammates with him, Wout Poels and Richie Porte, who did a fantastic job. It was a really interesting day from a team's point of view. Francis Dujeux played a bit of a team card as well. Movistar was head winner, Anacona, Pedlar Deschamps a couple of days ago, who did an outstanding job, I thought, for Quintana, because Quintana bridged initially up to Alejandro Valverde, who'd been allowed to get away. Valverde didn't seem able to help Quintana, but when Quintana caught Anacona was absolutely outstanding, and similarly behind, Wout Poels and Richie Porte were both outstanding for Froome.
Yeah, it was a nice tactic that Movistar tried, and I think they've been criticised a lot for their tactics in this Tour de France. But if you analyse the situation that they were in before this stage today, with the terrain as it was, a very long valley into a headwind between the Croix de Fer and Alpe d'Huez, if they were going to send Quintana out on his own, or try to send him out on his own over the Croix de Fer, I mean, he was just going to barbecue himself, wasn't he, between the Croix de Fer and Alpe d'Huez. So they had to get two guys working together somehow. And realistically, it was going to be difficult for Quintana to reach Anacona. So they had to try this bridging tactic of sending Valverde down the road, and very soon afterwards, a few hundred metres afterwards, Quintana. And it would have worked if they both had the legs. But really, it wasn't set up for them today. The Croix de Fer is a very long descent. And as I mentioned, there's the valley between Croix de Fer and the Alpe d'Huez. There was headwind. And they tried again on Alpe d'Huez and did it more successfully. But Valverde ultimately wasn't able to carry Quintana very far. Fortunately for them, he had winner Anacona, didn't he?
Quintana said at the top of the mountain he lost the Tour in the first week, and he was 159 down before they even hit a mountain. What he will finish the Tour 112 down. So on the one hand, he's correct that he did lose the Tour in the first week. I was speaking to Dan Lloyd at the finish, and he made the point that, oh, that's true. You look back at the crosswind stage and the time gap there. I think it was 128 he lost on that stage. And he asked the question, why did BMC and Sky not help more to distance Quintana, knowing the threat that he would be in the mountains? And actually, had those two teams worked in that move, the gap could have been 2.5, 3 minutes rather than 128.
You are listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Fripp.
Just to revisit what we were just saying about Movistar, last word on Movistar's tactics. I think due to the pendulum factor,
Daniel's pendulum, this could be a t-shirt.
Bearing in mind the pendulum factor, I think they played it exactly right. I think Eusebio Unzué, the team manager and the direct sportives, they knew that Quintana's chance was going to be the last two Alpine stages, and they put everything behind that, and I think they rode a pretty good race. Thibaut Pinot salvaged his tour, deserves a lot of credit, because previous incarnations of Thibaut Pinot would have lost concentration.
He'd been home by now, would they not?
He'd been
fishing in his pond.
They would have been sulking, they would have been playing Pro Cycling Manager, eating Walker's crisps or Watsits or whatever it is you eat in the Vosges region of France when you've left the Tour de France. Instead, he screwed his head back on and he came out swinging, didn't he, in the Alps. He was very disappointed, I think, when he didn't win the stage finishing in Praloo, when he fell on the descent of the Alos. I think it grated with him slightly that Romain Bardet was such a star of that stage, and this rivalry between them is bubbling nicely now. But you know, a great deal of courage that he showed coming back to
Romain Bardet lost the polka dot jersey, which he wore at the start of the day, polka dot helmet as well, but fortunately no polka dot shorts. However, he lost the polka dot jersey to Chris Froome, who is the first winner of the yellow jersey and the polka dot jersey since Lionel
Eddie Merckx.
Wow. Is that right? Yeah. Really? Wow.
He's also the first English-speaking winner, only the second English-speaking winner of the King of the Mountains title in the history of the Tour de France, after the great Robert Miller in 1984.
The King of the Mountains competition, though, it needs a revamp.
I know what you're going to say. No. Why? I think, you know, what more could you ask from it? I mean, it went down to the wire today. There were good climbers who were at the top of the classification. It wasn't Mickey Mouse, you know, Pierre Rolland kind of, you know.
Well,
Anthony Charteau. Okay. You know, sprinting for fourth category climbers. I think it fulfilled exactly the brief that it should have, the King of the Mountains competition this year.
Well, you can't argue that probably the best two climbers were first and second, because Quintana finished second in the classification. It's just that for Froome and Quintana, it's a total afterthought. Absolutely no interest in chasing points at all. And so,
it should be. I mean, you don't want the general classification riders are there to concentrate on the general classification. You know, it's a secondary competition. What do you want from it, Lionel? You're very demanding.
I would like to have seen it. So something that perhaps Thibaut Pinot could have gone for as well, you know.
So you want it to be for a competition for the second stringers?
I want to see a bit of a competition for it, yeah. I want to see...
I would suggest that you don't think it was much cop this year, because you weren't even paying attention. I kept trying to bring it up in the podcast and you refused to even broach the subject.
Well, Joaquin Rodriguez held the jersey for quite a long time, sometimes not while he was even leading the competition. Chris Froome was leading. There was no competition for it. That's what I'm saying. It wasn't a competition. It was just points awarded for people going over the
Lionel,
hills, mountains.
That's it. Yeah, you've got the hang of it. Listen, going back to the 80s, it was always one of the top three or four who won it. You know, I remember Eno winning it in 86, Miller obviously in 84. It generally did go to one of those top guys. It was in the 90s that it became something that guys could go for, sprinting for these points on minor climbs.
But I think we all have these kind of misty-eyed recollections of the first tours that we watched when we were, you know, when you were young once, Lionel, when we were 12, 13 and we got into the Tour de France. We thought the polka dot jersey, what a great thing it was, because it was kind of quirky. It was, you know, no other sport had a white jersey with red spots on it. However, I think it's always been an afterthought. I think it's always been a bit Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, it's the 40th anniversary of the polka dot jersey this year, and riding along on the Champs-Élysées, I mean, Romain Bardet, I'm assuming, will wear it, or will Quintana wear it?
Quintana will wear it.
That means that whoever's second in the white jersey competition, who's about an hour and three quarters down, will wear the white jersey.
It might be Thibaut Pinot, is it? Maybe Thibaut Pinot, who's in the white jersey. He must have the sheet there.
I think we need to move on before punches are thrown. We've already had some of those in the press room the last couple of days.
Or spitting, since Lionel argued last night. That was an argument we had after the podcast last night.
You tried to say that I was somehow advocating spitting simply because I was uncomfortable with the post-spitting witch hunt. Which I am. The guy, if he's been...
He basically said spitting was okay.
Forget it.
Okay, moving on. What a great stage to be talking absolute nonsense about. Quintana, He's going to win the tour, isn't he? I mean, it was brilliant. Not this year.
You haven't been paying attention. He hasn't been watching the polka dot jersey competition. You haven't been watching the general classification.
Actually, there's another rule we should dispense with. The unwritten rule that you can't attack on the final day. You can get back a minute and 12 on tomorrow, can he not?
Very unlike. No.
No, okay. All right.
Let's try and bring it back to the realm of, you know, the serious authoritative.
Okay. We're not actually drinking. So, yeah, Thibaut Pinot, overall, Romain Bardet will wear the white jersey. Warren Barguil is third, and Thibaut Pinot is fourth. That's a very promising outcome for the French riders. Three of the top four in the young riders' classification points to a bright future. And I think those guys have all done really well. It's Barguil's first tour. Bardet and Pinot had a lot to live up to this year, and I think they both come away with stage wins, and they can be pretty proud of that.
Well, I think it was a massively tall order for them to match last year's performances. And I think, in a certain way, they have done it, and they've surpassed last year's performances, because they're in very exalted company this year with the big four. Mm. It's really gone up a notch. And I think all of them have had to develop new strings to their bow. I think Bardet, he's won a stage this year, which he probably didn't look capable of doing last year, although he sort of steady-eddied into the top six or top seven last year. And Pinot as well. He has looked very at home climbing with the best climbers in the world, with Froome, Quintana. And Barguil, for his first Tour de France, has shown a lot of promise and ridden with immense maturity for a 23-year-old who's been dropped pretty much every day in the mountains, but has not panicked and has yo-yoed back and forth off the back of the group. Talking of yo-yos, are you aware what his nickname is?
Wawa.
Wawa, it's quite good, isn't it?
Wawa. Wawa. Barguil and Pinot also had nasty crashes, very nasty crashes and bad injuries.
And Bardet had a day when he was feeling very unwell. Heat stroke and very bad headache, and they've all had their woes to get over, you know, whether it's been Bardet's mechanical problems yesterday and Pinot crashing on the descent when he looked like he might win the stage. And of course, the other thing, talking about the morale of young riders, they basically had a finish between them at Mons. They had it in their hands. One of them or the other could have won that stage, and they were caught napping, really. And the arm, I think the photo of Steve Cummings coming over the line at Mond with the victory celebration, I think it's Bardet waving his arm at Pinot, because they didn't cooperate. They, one or other of them could have won that stage, and they basically ensured that they both lost.
Question for you guys: which one of those three is capable of winning a Tour de France? Because Warren Barguil, who a lot of people think is the answer, he gave a very interesting interview the other day to L'Equipe and said, I don't see myself being able to make the kind of sacrifices that Chris Froome makes. My family is too important for me. He's tried moving to the Côte d'Azur. He stayed about 2 months. He's moved back to Brittany now, wants to be near his family. So he was speaking almost as though he doesn't imagine himself ever.
Honestly, I can't see any of them winning the Tour, honestly.
No, and I think the big problem, well, the thing is that we've got Quintana, who looks like he will be a future Tour winner. To answer your very first question, will Quintana win the Tour? Yes, I think he will, but again, it will be dependent on the route. You know, time trialling is not his forte, and I think, again, the three Frenchmen, that's an area that all three would need to make dramatic improvements at in order to challenge overall. And when you look at, you know, when you look at the top 10 as it's likely to be, Hessink, Bauke Mollema, you know, they've had good and bad days, sort of yo-yoing a bit. Matthias Frank, somebody on Twitter suggested that he had ridden into the top 10 a la Zubeldia by being fairly anonymous. I mean, he's followed very well, but he hasn't really put his, you know, put himself on the front foot very much. When you look at the way that the GC always goes, I mean, it's 10 minutes to fifth or sixth place, and then it's 20 odd minutes, and then it's, you know, the time gaps are significant. And, you know, Barguil, who's nominally in the GC race, over half an hour down. So really, there's a huge jump from this realm into the sort of top six, seven.
Okay, let's talk about another, well, let's hear from another young rider, a debutant, Luke Rowe of Team Sky, who has been more concerned as a domestique working for Chris Froome. I caught up with him at the summit of Alpe d'Huez, and here's what he had to say.
Luke, I think we can safely say that you're going to finish your debut Tour de France. How does that feel?
It was a big goal of mine from the start to get through the race, you know, make it to Paris, done that, but the most important thing is, you know, not only to make it to Paris, but to get there with the yellow jersey. And it's just quite emotional. It's incredible to settle in and realise what we've achieved.
You've just finished the stage, so were you aware as you came up the mountain what was happening up above?
Yeah. Well, I was going back and forth to the car to service because I was struggling to hear through the earpiece. And I knew the gap was increasing, but not as fast as the kilometres were coming down. But yeah, when I finally went back and found out that I still got a minute odd advantage, it was just surreal.
And what was it like riding up the Alp there? There's been a lot of talk of, you know, hostility towards Team Sky. Did you experience any of that there?
No, I tried to stay in the middle of the group. So, you know, a guy to my right and a guy to the left. So I had a couple of bodyguards, but no, absolutely no problem at all. Just a lot of encouragement and a lot of happy fans. But I felt my legs up every single climb. That last climb today just didn't even feel my legs, you know, just absolutely buzzing off it. And incredible.
What does it mean to you personally to finish the tour as well?
It puts you into quite a select group, you know. Not many guys get to compete in the Tour de France and then, you know, less people finish it. So to finish it, but then to be in that select group, being in a Tour de France winning team, I mean, I'm never going to be a GC rider myself, so that's as close as I can get to having, you know, GC Grand Tour success. And it's just an incredible moment. I think we'll save the celebrations for tomorrow night. We've got the chef to make a few burgers and we'll have a few beers for sure. A nice relaxed one, but we'll save the magnums of Belvedere vodka for tomorrow night.
Follow us on Twitter at cycling_podcast or on our website, thecyclingpodcast.com.
We've just had Chris Froome in for his press conference, winner's press conference, which is always held the night before the final stage. A bit presumptuous, but assuming nothing happens on the road to Paris, he will win his second tour.
Quite odd that he didn't wear the yellow jersey, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, they usually wear the yellow jersey.
Never seen that before. Anyway.
But he handled himself very well. There weren't any tricky questions for him, really, in the press conference, as there have been throughout the tour. There was an interview, I think in L'Equipe, was it, with Claudio Corti, his old manager at Barloworld, who basically expressed his surprise that Froome had been transformed from the journeyman professional that he was at Barloworld in 2008, 2009, into this tour winner. Now, Froome said that Corti back in 2008 had actually said this guy will finish on the podium of the tour. But you know what? I'm always sceptical of former managers whose riders go on to great things. They have their own agenda. They have their own... we've seen it with Bradley Wiggins as well. All the managers who looked after Wiggins throughout his career and didn't identify that he was a tour winner are obviously going to feel at best a little bit silly, at worst a little bit bitter, I think.
Yeah, and Claudio Corti, I must say, has changed his tune slightly. I spoke to him two or three days ago. He was in the press room and I was talking to him about Froome's time at Barloworld, and he was quite ambivalent, expressed similar sentiments to the ones that were in L'Equipe today, sort of, again, expressing surprise, really, that Froome had become so good. But I vividly remember speaking to him 3 or 4 years ago and him saying precisely, you know, that he thought Froome was a Tour de France podium contender or potential winner in the future. He said, I can see him finishing in the top five in the Tour de France and maybe doing even better than that. And that was in 2008, 2009, when, as you say, Rich, he wanted really to tell the world that he had unearthed this uncut diamond.
Yeah. There are always agendas going on when these guys offer comment. How do we wrap this up then? Where does this tour stand, and where does Chris Froome stand? He's now a double winner of the tour, and there aren't many of those.
Well, I thought the most interesting thing was that he's 30 years old. He's about to become a father later this year, and he's talking about carrying on to his professional career to 36, 37, 38. I mean, that's a long time. One of the things to bear in mind with Chris Froome in terms of, you know, his engine as a bike rider, he didn't start as a professional on the road at a young age. And I do think, I don't know whether this is just kind of, you know, absorbed knowledge, but I do think that more than age, the factor is miles on the clock rather than, and just the ability to keep living this life, sacrificing himself as, you know, people, well, you've said, Daniel, Barguil can't see himself sacrificing himself the way that Chris Froome does. And I think that was the thing that caught Bradley Wiggins out. He'd done it once. It worked. You know, he put everything into winning in 2012 and realised that that wasn't the life he wanted to carry on living, even for another year or another 2 years. And I think that will be the biggest test of Chris Froome, whether he wants to live this kind of life going forwards. I think the thing that will probably help him will be things like a very good friendship with Richie Port, who's another sort of serious and a slightly younger than him, I think. You know, so they can, you know, they've obviously got a good relationship, and that's the life they live. But I think, you know, another 8 years at this level, that's really quite a remarkable thing to even be contemplating.
It's one thing to say that when you're at the top of your game, when you're in decline, when the body's not responding quite as it used to, it might be quite different, especially for somebody who has been a winner. Somebody like Jens Vogt, who went on to 42, I think 43 even. You know, he wasn't somebody who was winning the Tour de France, so he could carry on doing the job that he was doing. For a champion, it's harder.
I think the next challenge really for Chris Froome is to capture hearts as well as capture titles and capture Tours de France. I don't think he really has embedded himself in the British national psyche yet, or in the kind of collective psyche of professional cycling, or certainly not in their affections. And I think, you know, if you look at someone like Alberto Contador, that came quite late with him. I mean, there were doping controversies with Contador, but eventually his racing style and his panache, it won over in terms of how we sort of analyse his whole career. And with Froome at the moment, what people see is a very efficient, very polite, charming guy, an efficient rider, a very charming guy, but not someone who really excites them and who rides for a team which, to a certain extent, hasn't really ingratiated itself with the wider public beyond Great Britain.
No, but I think, you know, in terms of capturing people's hearts and affections, what's happened to him, the perception of what's happened to him in terms of the roadside abuse, the spitting, there was more of that today, there was a cup of urine thrown at him. That will ironically help his standing in Great Britain, because the narrative there, we're not there, but I can imagine that the narrative there is that, you know, our boy is being abused.
I think from a wider thing as well, just his mask slipping a little bit on the road today and yesterday, looking fallible, looking like he might crack. I mean, it's counterintuitive really, isn't it? But when a rider is on the back foot, their popularity shoots up. People like to see, you know, I mean, I can imagine France going wild for Pinot's victory today because of the woes that he suffered earlier in this race. And so, I mean, you can't engineer a weakness out on the road, but just seeing him wobble a bit today might well have endeared him to a few more people. He dug in. He didn't just sort of motor along. Oh, that's not a joke, and it's not a sort of, you know, I mean, his bike was checked for a month.
There has been rumours of...
Yeah, exactly.
I read something today which suggested that his low heart rate on Mont Ventoux or La Pierre Saint-Martin was possibly because he had a motor in his bike. That is absurd. You don't go any less hard if you've got a motor in your bike if you're trying to win the Tour de France.
Is it not because he started life as a magic bean in a test tube, as we discussed yesterday, that carried around in someone's suitcase?
Yeah, people like that do tend to have very low heart rates.
Should just say, Froome wasn't the only one whose bike was checked for basically motors. That's what they're looking for, isn't it? Thibaut Pinot as well, Alberto Contador, Nairo Quintana, Alejandro Valverde also had their bikes checked.
That list suggests that it's not random.
No. Well, no, of course it's not random.
they're the top guys. Yeah,
if you're going to catch, you want to...
Yeah, but okay, well, but key people today were domestiques, Wout Poels, Richie Port, winner Anacona. You know, they performed key roles. And it is funny, isn't it? And it applies to drug testing as well. These guys, I mean, you know, last year Nibali had a rider on his team who did test positive for EPO, and I bet he wasn't tested all that much.
Yeah, very good point. And if, I mean, really, the UCI ought to get a grip and just test absolutely everything every day, and, you know, for an entire tour, and then put this issue to bed.
It's going to be difficult.
What about tomorrow? Champs-Élysées, big day for Mark Cavendish, isn't it? He's not going to have Mark Renshaw with him. Will that affect him too much? I don't think necessarily, because I think there are enough big trains there for him to latch onto. And actually, on occasions in the recent past, the train has, I wouldn't say proved a hindrance, his train, but he's certainly been pretty adept at jumping between other other wheels and finding his own way much in the same way that he did at the start of his career. So important afternoon for Cavendish, or evening for Cavendish tomorrow. Contract talks scheduled in the morning, I think, reported by Het Nieuwsblad earlier this week.
It's an important day for a lot of people. I mean, John Degenkolb hasn't won a stage. Alexander Kristoff hasn't won a stage. Peter Sagan's not necessarily going to be, you know, he'll be there or thereabouts, but he's not one of the favourites for it, I wouldn't have thought.
No, well, in the sense that Sagan will have conserved more energy than probably most, if not all, of the other sprinters, because he gets over the mountains more easily than all the others. So he, you never know, he might pull something out. And Kristoff is the guy who we always expect to come good the longer the race goes on and the harder it becomes.
Very good point. Sagan, though, on the flip side of that, has done an awful lot of work in recent days, getting in breaks 12 days in a row.
And if I was to back anyone to be in the igloo tonight at 7 a.m, it would probably be Sagan.
With Filippo Pozzato.
Yeah. Should you say, yeah, the igloo is a nightclub here in Alpe d'Huez, which I think we've all been in at one point or another. The teams are all staying up here at Alpe d'Huez, but we have got to get ourselves to Paris by road, so we've got to get down the mountain.
Right, well, I want to say one thing. The other thing that's happening in Paris tomorrow is La Course, the women's race. We would love to be there to cover that race. It's going to be impossible to get there. It's a 6.5 hour journey. That's if the roads are good. It's going to take us a couple of hours to get off the mountain tonight. We'll drive as far as we can up the road, but it's very unlikely that we're going to get there in time for La Course, which is a real problem, because we would like to be able to cover it.
It is, yeah. Daniel and I made it in the nick of time last year, but the drive wasn't anything like as long. It was a good 150k shorter, and we didn't have to get down off the mountain. It's getting TV coverage. That's one of the plus points of it, but it's finishing at 3:30, and like you say, we'll have to get up very early and then rely on the traffic being good.
That is the unmistakable sound of Ciro Scognamiglio working, tapping away. That was him just writing his name, actually, at the top, in massive, massive font, Ciro.
And the font is called Britannic. Yes, it's
Britannic.
For you, because...
In size 22.
No, because Lionel talk about TV transmission, woman course tomorrow. Richard, if we had for our podcast a TV transmission, our listeners could see tears in my eyes, because this is ending.
This is ending. This is the future. And Ciro, listen, I just want to echo what was said earlier by these guys. Thank you very much again for being a regular on the podcast. Much appreciated. You bring a smile to people's faces, and we are making you an honorary peddler de charme for today.
I hope so. Thanks to everyone.
Okay, that was Ciro. Over and out from Ciro. We'll wrap it up there, shall we, chaps? We'll be back tomorrow, Lionel from Paris, for a final podcast, and then next week there will be a review of the tour for friends of the podcast. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com, and it'll be our review. It'll have the same kind of feel and sound as Kilometre Zero. It'll be like an extended Kilometre Zero episode, so of the same music and everything. So sign up to become a friend of the podcast for that. That's all for now. Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you. Won't see you tomorrow.
Okay, bye, Daniel.
For the best analysis, discussions and interviews from the 2015 Tour de France, listen to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.